Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Tamarind Learning Podcast, where host Cindy Radu speaks with experts on many topics relevant to the ultra-high net worth family and family office. Cindy was author and co-author of numerous articles related to trusts, family enterprises, and estate planning, and co-authored Taxation and Estate Planning in Canada for many years. She also shares her expertise as a consultant, advisor, and educator to those in the family enterprise space. Cindy is the Chief Learning Officer of Tamarind Learning Canada, an online wealth education platform that develops practical, foundational learning programs for beneficiaries and their advisors to help them prepare for the responsible stewardship of wealth.
Welcome to the Tamarind Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Cindy Radu, Chief Learning Officer for Tamarind Learning Canada. Tamarind Learning is an online wealth education platform that develops practical foundational learning programs for beneficiaries and their advisors to help them prepare for the responsible stewardship of wealth. As part of this platform, I have the privilege to speak with experts on topics relevant to families of wealth and family offices. In this episode, I am absolutely delighted to welcome our guest, Dr. Sherilyn Hale, President of Watermark Philanthropic Council. Sherilyn works with leading philanthropists, generous families, and social purpose organizations across Canada and the Caribbean. For me, it's actually very humbling to share some of Sherilyn's professional credentials. She holds undergraduate degrees in both theology and psychology, as well as a graduate degree in philanthropy and a doctor of education degree. In addition to her impressive degrees, Sherilyn holds the Master Financial Advisor Philanthropy designation, is a member of the Canadian Association of Gift Planners. She is also a chartered director, and she is a certified governance advisor and trainer with BoardSource, where she has the opportunity to blend corporate and family governance in her work with foundations and nonprofit boards. Sherilyn, we met at a conference in 2022 where you were a keynote speaker. You are one of the most sincere, gracious, and inspiring speakers I've had the pleasure of listening to. You've been a lifelong philanthropist yourself, I think following your parents' footsteps, as your family was, as I recall, very involved in philanthropy in the Caribbean. And I'd like you to just share a little bit about your early experiences in philanthropy and how that's influenced your work and your volunteer roles, as well as your research.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. You know, my experience is not unlike the experience of many who find themselves as givers in philanthropy and the charitable space. I speak with and have spoken with philanthropists so many over the years. What drives you? What motivates you to get involved, to participate, to be generous? And most often it starts, you know, from their parents, grandparents, other special people in their lives that planted a seed in them, even in the absence of wealth, right? That whatever they had They gave generously, they shared, they volunteered, they were active. And that is part of my story as well. My parents for 40 years lived lives of service in the helping space, and including my formative years in the Caribbean, and that's why that part of the world holds a special place in my heart. But their example of service and caring for others, participating, being attentive to, you know, what I can do, where I can help, and to live a life of service, that's certainly been instrumental to me. I started my career as a fundraiser, working for some fantastic organizations that continue to make an impact here in Canada and in other parts of the world, and then started my consulting business in philanthropy about 10 years ago, and in that capacity get to work with generous people all the time, which is a privilege and an honor and a great deal of fun.
Well, the families you work with are very privileged to have you. I'm confident in saying that they really learn a lot from you, and their philanthropy flourishes as a result of having you as part of their advisor team. So I want to dig into this whole area that you've done a lot of research on with regard to family philanthropy governance. So there can't be anyone else who has a PhD in education based on research on family philanthropy governance. And I understand that you won an award for your research in this area, and that you, as a result of your research, produced a model that helps families approach their giving in a meaningful way that works. And we'll dig into that a little bit. But first, I think it would be helpful if we start with the word governance and what that means, because it's used a lot, it's thrown out there, can be confusing and misunderstood. So how do you define that term, and how is it relevant to the families who are looking at giving and being generous with their philanthropy?
Yeah, I think that is such a great place to start, because sometimes the word can be a barrier. You know, in its most simple form, governance is how groups of people organize themselves to make decisions. So in the case of giving families, it's, you know, how do we do this, right? How do we figure this out so that it can be a great experience? I think that in my experience, a lack of clarity is one of the biggest barriers, and it leads to confusion and can lead to conflict. Mm-hmm. For families who may give through an incorporated entity, such as a private foundation, and then often it's a blend between the corporate governance. Those are the things they have to do as an incorporated entity, and the family governance. Those are the relational considerations that when you build in and have in place, they help ensure that the family is able to work together in a productive and enjoyable manner. In the case of donor advised funds, for example, which are incredibly popular for many families as a giving vehicle, there is also a need for governance, because you need to be able to come together and make decisions together. So governance, I think, is incredibly important. Again, just thinking is how we do this, how we come together to make decisions and really make this sing.
So it's interesting you talk about conflict, and, you know, I think about that outside of the philanthropic sector, but for some reason I think it's going to be all, you know, smiles and happy around philanthropy. So what kinds of things do you see that can cause conflict when families are starting to get into these types of conversations about giving?
Yeah, I have found in my work with families that philanthropy does tend to be a space where there's less conflict, perhaps, than in other areas of the family life. It's and I think that's one of the beautiful things about families coming together and wanting to give together. It can be a safer space. It can be where it can be easier for people to get consensus and to find some common ground. And there is some research that suggests that when that happens in the philanthropic space, that there's a spillover benefit to other parts of the family life. But common challenges that I've observed, there's kind of a continuum ranging from great uncertainty that leads to paralysis all the way to the other end of that continuum, which would be high conflict, right? And so typically when I see that, I observe there's a lack of a plan. They haven't figured out a plan. They haven't explored the components to a plan. That roles and responsibilities are not clear. So people don't really know, you know, why am I here? What's my function? What do I have to do? What are the expectations? And I think broadly, you know, it feels bad when you feel like you're not meeting someone's expectations, but if you don't know what they are to begin with, right, that can be a bit frustrating. And then either too little governance or too much governance relative to the family. So these are all areas typically where an advisor can be very helpful to a family to help them craft an approach that is right-sized and customized to them. There's no one size fits all. There's no one right way of doing things. There are components that we know are important and useful, but then we have to craft that to really suit the family.
Love it. Thank you. Well, let's get a little bit more into this research that you've done, because I think this will be very beneficial for our listeners and for myself. What key things did you learn in your research that you can share with us that might help or inspire families on?
Oh, I learned so many things. It was hard to write it up with only 200 pages, but I'll be brief today. You know, one of the things that I think can really help families, and I focus on this when I start working with a family, is you are special. You are unique. Every family is distinct, and families come together in so many different ways. They have unique history. They have norms and behavior that shape how they relate to each other. Families vary in size, in their generational ages and stages, as well as in their goals and objectives for giving. So in my research, I call these differentiators. These are factors that inform the choices that families can make about how they approach their giving overall. And again, it's really helpful for families to understand there's no one right way to approach their giving together. There's only ways that can best help them flourish and in the impact that they want to make in the community. So that's something that's helpful. There's also things that I find very inspiring that came out of my research. And the biggest thing there is that generous families tend to really care about each other, right? They feel some connection, some shared sense of history, identity. Typically, there are values. We each have our own values that drive our action. But in my work with families, often there are some profound shared values. What are the things that as members of this family we share and that we can stand on together going forward? And then certainly that they care about the difference that they can make in the lives of others. And that is such fruitful soil, right, to grow your approach to giving and to philanthropy. With that caring also comes a sense of accountability. And that was also a big theme that came out of my research about, you know, how families organize themselves for their giving, a sense of accountability within themselves, being accountable to themselves for being whole, showing up with their full selves to the process, honoring their good intent, accountability to each other in the family, you know, participating, being active, following through on commitments, And then accountability to the larger community. And that's a very big conversation in the philanthropy world these days is how are philanthropists showing up as donors to the charitable partners and organizations in the community? So I think that that sense of care and accountability really helped to contribute to a productive process.
Sounds like a really, really great process. Can you give us maybe an example of maybe something that you came up with in your research, of a specific family example or something you commonly see in the work that you do?
A great example that I can share with you is a beautiful family that were really determined to use philanthropy as a way to strengthen their family and to express the relationships that they have with each other. And in the crafting of their mission statement, their philanthropic mission statement, it's what I called in my research a dual mission. It reflected what they wanted the giving to accomplish for their family, but also what they wanted their giving to accomplish in the community. And it goes something like this. We strive to support each other's efforts to grow both as a family and as individuals, and to show kindness and respect to each other in our everyday lives. In this context, we support endeavors that XYZ, right? And, you know, I just thought that was so profound. It was a family that was so clear about their sense of accountability to each other, right? Their sense of personal accountability, how I'm going to show up to this experience of being generous as a family. And I just thought it was so wonderful. And the parents were very intentional in how they crafted their approach to philanthropy, how they structured their governance. Interestingly, it's a family that uses a donor advised fund for their giving, so that they didn't have to worry about the corporate governance aspects, but they had a very defined process within their family, and they're not a big family, but you know, they crafted their governance in response to what they wanted the giving to make possible in the lives of their children and in the family. And I think that's such a great example.
That is, I really thank you for sharing that example. How can families get started or get organized on their governance? What do they need to think about or put in place to start crafting their own mission and statement and accountabilities and that kind of fun stuff?
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
It is fun, and I often encourage families to think of it as a journey, right? It's not a destination. No one, even on corporate boards, you never get the governance. It's never done. It's kind of a living, breathing, organic process that you have to attend to. You have to keep on it. You have to evolve and change. And families are always evolving and changing over time. And so there are four areas that I encourage families to look at. They can do this independently. They can get the support of an advisor. But they're all grounded in conversation, in exploration. It's never the case where someone can just write up your governance plan and give it to you and say, here, do this, right? The best approaches to governance really emerge out of the family, from the family, reflect the family. So the first one, which is the most important because it drives everything else, and from structure to approach and strategy, is to clarify purposes. You know, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to give? Why do you want to give together? In some way, what do you want the giving to make possible as individual family members, but for the family as well? And then, of course, what do you want the giving to make possible in the community and mapping that out in a meaningful way? So as in the case, the example that I just shared with you, if the development of younger family members is a key objective, then your approach to governance, and remember how you organize, needs to include the younger members of the family. You need to provide on-ramps for them to participate. They need to have a meaningful role, some opportunities to be responsible, and to lead, right? So your purposes really drive governance in a really fundamental way and bring clarity. The second area families should focus on is the relationships and the roles and responsibilities within those relationships. It can begin by looking at who's eligible to participate and who wants to participate. Again, involvement in giving should be voluntary as opposed to mandated. In large, complex families, the eligibility may require more thoughtfulness to ensure that there are meaningful opportunities for all those who are interested. So if you have a foundation, for example, with a board, it may not be realistic for everyone to be a director, right? But there might be other ways that family members can participate. So commonly families will introduce some criteria for participation, some terms of service. So it's not a lifetime appointment where no one else ever gets a chance. The use of committees or other working groups that help to involve and keep the door open, plan for the next groups of family members to be able to participate. Then, of course, you know, once you've identified that, you have to think, okay, so what are they going to do, right? What are the roles? What are the responsibilities and the expectations? You know, what am I going to do? How often? How much time is that going to take? For families where there's busy professionals, they may have young families, time can be a thing, right? And so being very clear about what's involved is incredibly important. Charitable structure used for giving is going to have some implications for roles and responsibilities. Again, if it's a foundation, there are legal and fiduciary responsibilities, things that have to be done. So those who are participating should know what those things are to protect the foundation, to protect the family. But even giving through a donor advised fund, there are still processes that should be clear to all those who are participating. So getting clear about these matters goes a long way to ensure a smooth experience and a meaningful experience. For some families, there's also some external relationships that can support their giving, whether that's a non-family member on a foundation board. It could be other content experts in the areas where they want to give. So really understanding that network of relationships. My research called these the enablers, the things that help families bring their philanthropy to life. The third area is to then kind of draw it together, map and document a plan. There is something very powerful in writing things down, and it helps to augment poor memories. So, you know, you can get around the table, oh yeah, that's a great idea, we all agree. And by the next meeting, you even forget what you talked about, right? So mapping it out on paper, some of the logistical aspects. So exploring questions like, how often are we going to meet and in what ways? Where are we going to meet? How will we make decisions? How will we find giving opportunities? What's the process that we use when we have these giving opportunities and we have to sort through them and make some decisions? Some families only meet once a year. Some families meet much more often. Some families use a majority votes decision-making process, but consensus decision-making sets a more robust standard, and research suggests that that makes for a healthier outcome from the family. You want to be candid. Do the founders of this thing, do they have any special discretion, right? To be candid around that, around the table, can prevent a lot of frustration. Some families allocate funds across family members to disperse. Other families keep those disbursements small, and then the bulk of the funding, they make decisions jointly. Again, there's no one right way, but making sure that there's clarity and consensus on that clarity goes a long way so that people feel that they're integral to the process, that they have a voice, and that they can participate in a meaningful way. The last area is to just get going, do it, implement, and then tweak and evolve as you go, because philanthropy is a journey. You learn as you go. And again, the family is always evolving and changing. I usually suggest you check in every 2 to 3 years, have a look at your governance, your structure, your process. Certainly in larger contexts, you also need some policies in place, written, you know, all these decisions that you're making about how things are going to be, writing them down in a policy or a manual, so that there's clarity, both for those around the table and those other family members who may be coming on. And then just to reiterate, it's a journey. And so much good comes from these conversations around governance, because family members, they learn more about each other. They understand each other better. And one of the other findings in my research was around social capital in families is a muscle. And philanthropy gives families the opportunity to exercise those muscles and enhances the degree of social capital they have with each other that only brings good things for them in the context of their family and the other elements of their family life.
Sherilyn, that was amazing. I just want to wrap up with a couple of takeaways. The first one is that there's no one right way to approach governance for family philanthropy, but you need to have fun. So talk, explore, enjoy the process. And, you know, maybe you need a guide or advisor to help your family out. And those people are out there for sure to help you. But ultimately, every family's giving journey comes out of the family. I love this, from the family and reflects the family. So the key is to get going and get started. So Sherilyn, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and warmth on Tamarind Learning Podcast. I'm confident that our listeners will find your comments helpful and inspirational as they embark on or continue on their philanthropic journey.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,